That was my friend Walker. He did an excellent job for me. Oh, there you go. So before I begin, some of you may know, some of you may not know. I guess those are the only two options, really. I've been doing seminary education for the last couple of years, and so I just want to thank everyone here for putting up with me as I do the prayer time, teach the John class, do stuff like this. And if you haven't enjoyed it, or you've just been bearing through it, then I don't know what to tell you, but... So this morning, I would ask that if you're willing and able, that you please stand for the reading of the gospel. I'll be reading from John chapter 8, and Ernie doesn't know this, but I'll be reading a couple verses from starting in 31. You don't have to display that, Ernie, and then I'll jump ahead to verse 53. So beginning in verse 31. Then Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." They answered him, "We are descendants of Abraham, and we have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying this? You will be made free." Jesus answered them, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin." Now I'll jump ahead to verse 53. "Are you greater than our father Abraham who died? The prophets also died. Who do you claim to be?" Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, he of whom you say, 'He is our God,' though you do not know him. But I know him. If I were to say I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your ancestor Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. Then the Jews said to him, 'You are not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham?' Jesus said to them, 'Very truly I tell you, before Abraham was, I am.' So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." The word of God for the people of God. Please be seated. So this morning I'm going to provide kind of a meditation on this section and two of the themes in this section, as opposed to just doing a exegesis or an explanation of particular words in context and so on. If you want that, you can come to our John class on Sunday mornings. So, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, this morning, we have woken up in a world of uncertainty. Once again, the economy is uncertain. And who knows what tomorrow holds for our employment, our investments, our retirements, our debts. Whatever semblance of peace we had for a few odd years is entirely uncertain. We live in an absolute mess of uncertainty. This morning's gospel reading is challenging and obscure in many ways. Because the gospel reading is so obscure and so rich theologically, I have decided to use Exodus to help capture two of the themes of John chapter 8. The entire narrative of John chapter 8 swirls around the identity of a Jew from Nazareth and the confidence of the people who are questioning him. In just a few short verses, within a much longer discussion, the certainty and confidence of the questioners is shattered, and the guy from Nazareth claims to be God. Some of you might be wondering, how does he claim to be God? In verse 58 of chapter 8, Jesus declares that before Abraham was, I am. He forces us to consider and to think back to Exodus chapter 3, which was this morning's Old Testament reading. In chapter 3 of Exodus, God reveals his name to Moses. Firstly, however, God declares himself to be the God of the ancestral. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then he declares himself to be a God who observes. I have observed the misery of my people. And finally, he declares himself to be a God who delivers. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them. God informs Moses that Moses is going to be his instrument of deliverance. But Moses, perhaps rightfully so, is a little uncertain of this mission, and maybe even uncertain of this God. Moreover, Moses is unsure of himself, and not without reason. After all, he has recently killed a man. He's been on the run. Now he's a desert shepherd, and he's come to the point where he's talking to a bush that appears to be on fire. As I said, perhaps Moses is most uncertain of this God. Hence his question in verse 13 of Exodus chapter 3. If I show up in Egypt attempting to fulfill this mission for you, and the people want more detail, can I get a name to give them? What is your name? You can sense the tentativeness of this whole situation as you read. Moses isn't doubting, but he isn't certain of anything either. So he asks for a name. What Moses gets in response isn't really a name. It is a name, but it also very much so is not a name. It's more of a radically open, undefinable assertion about the qualities or quality of this God who has just chosen to reveal himself. Many scholars attend to the ancient reality that knowing a name gave control and power over someone, whether human or divine. The ability to speak a name in magic opened up possibilities for incantation and attention. It is like knowing the name of someone in a large crowd and calling the name out, then seeing the person stop in their tracks and look around. In ancient times, names could also be descriptive, hinting at origins or qualities. But this God doesn't allow for that. He's not going to be captured in some conceptual box or controlled through incantations. He's not like any other God. This God reveals himself on his own terms and provides content to his radically open-ended name. What content does he provide to Moses to help Moses understand who he is? Verse 7 of Exodus chapter 3. He sees suffering. He hears the cries. Verse 8. He is a deliverer. And verse 12. He is a God who is with when he says, I will be with you. As we know from the story, it all comes to pass, just as God said. But through it all, Moses is uncertain, yet he hopes in the God who has revealed himself as the deliverer and the one who will be with him. But it's not only Moses who is uncertain. The people of Israel are entirely uncertain as they enter the wilderness. Within two verses of entering the wilderness in Exodus chapter 16, the people look back and long for the certainty of Egypt. They long for the certainty of Pharaoh's mythical power. Oh, how we miss Egypt. Moses, why did you bring us out here? In Egypt, we had bread and meat. They loved their slavery because it was certain. It was security. We mock them now sometimes when we read this. How could you want to go back to Egypt? But aren't we the same? We long for and want certainty, even though it is illusory and mythical. we would become, and perhaps have become, slaves for the sake of certainty. If we get the feeling of satiety and security, we would willingly place ourselves in bonds. So there it is. The name Jesus now declares of himself goes back to the Exodus narrative. And as we said, the certainty of the questioners is the occasion for Jesus to reveal himself in this way. But what are his questioners certain of? They are certain of their lineage as the chosen people, which goes back to a promise God made to Abraham. They are certain that they've gotten it right because of that lineage. After all, they know God. They are certain of how God operates in the world, what pleases God, and certainly they are pleasing to God. And they are certain that they know exactly who God is. Perhaps that's why they pick up stones to kill him. They know exactly who he is. Perhaps that's why they kill him later. They love their certainty more than the God who delivered them. They don't long to know him beyond their rules and rituals. Jesus' questioners love their certainty more than the God who called their ancestor Abraham out of his father's house. They love their certainty more than the God who promised a child to the nearly dead Abraham and Sarah, out of which a covenant was born. Thus, they have entirely misunderstood the life of Abraham, and God, in Jesus of Nazareth, is attempting to demonstrate their misunderstanding. Abraham was a man who followed God, hoped, trusted, and lived entirely by faith. But he never trusted his own certainties, even a little. The questioner's certainty and confidence prevent them from seeing who Jesus is. And therefore, Jesus says to his questioners, before all these things, before all the promises, before all your confidence and certainty, before the rules and heavy burdens you have heaped on people, before your own righteousness was even a thought, I am. It is at this juncture that many would ask, isn't Christianity supposed to be a religion of certainty? Are we not supposed to be certain of our faith in order to avoid hell? Aren't we supposed to be certain of our beliefs? The funny thing about certainty or about faith is that as soon as it's certain, it's no longer faith. That is not to say that we should be doubtful, fearful, and entirely caught in a spiritual limbo, but that we do not cling to our own certainties. Instead, we live a life of faith marked by uncertainty. The Apostle Paul demonstrates as much from this morning's reading from Philippians. One preacher has pointed out the tentative nature of Paul's phrasing. I want to know Christ. I want to. And the power of his resurrection and the sharing of his sufferings by becoming like him in his death, if somehow I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Again, I want to know Christ. Hold Paul's tentative phrasing in your mind for a moment. Now imagine Paul before his conversion when he was Saul. What would Saul, before becoming Paul, respond to Jesus in John chapter 8 when Jesus says to the Pharisees, "You don't know my Father"? Perhaps he would say something like our reading this morning, except in the active voice, Philippians 3, verses 5 through 6. I am confident in the flesh. I know God. I was circumcised on the eighth day. I am a member of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. I am a Pharisee of the law, and I am entirely righteous under the law and blameless. Surely that's how Paul prior to his conversion would have responded to Jesus. But now, after meeting the resurrected Lord on the road to Damascus, his certainties are shattered. In fact, he counts them all as rubbish. Now he lives in uncertainty about earthly things. As Paul writes his letter to the church at Philippi, he is imprisoned, but has an ever-present longing to know Jesus Christ. And that is the essence of his faith. Paul has become uncertain of many things, and therefore, he lives entirely by faith. Perhaps like Paul, we need to have our certainties shattered by the God who decisively revealed himself in Jesus of Nazareth. Perhaps in the spirit of the season of Lent, there is good news that your certainties can be crushed into uncertainty, which does not mean despair and fear, but it makes room for hope in Jesus. It makes room for a deeper longing to know Jesus. At this moment in our contemporary culture, where slowly all the former certainties are crumbling, is a time ripe for new and profound faith, the kind that calls one to follow in the wilderness. Let me put it in terms of the narrative we've been meditating on this morning. At one time, you lived in the kingdom of Pharaoh as slaves to sin and death. You longed to be free from your bondage, but had no way out. Or perhaps you were like me and had no idea that you were in bondage. But then Christ came to us as our Moses and brought us out of Egypt through his cross and resurrection. And now some of you, and maybe some of you are considering, through baptism have followed him in his death and crossed the Red Sea to freedom. But it turns out that that freedom is a wilderness, and we're called to follow yet a little longer. Sometimes we turn back like the people of Israel, seeing Egypt in the distance and longing for illusory certainty and security that Pharaoh offers. As I said, slavery is a certainty. We know what to expect. It gives us temporary comfort. We are called to leave behind old certainties and to follow Jesus by faith. In John chapter 6, Jesus declares himself to be the bread of life, just like our ancestors ate the bread of heaven in the wilderness. We too are in a wilderness relying on his bread. And now we're sustained by it. The ancestors followed a pillar of fire by night through the desert and a pillar of cloud by day. But now we follow Jesus, who is our light. In John chapter 8, the same God that appeared at Mount Horeb is present. Only now he has been decisively revealed as Jesus of Nazareth. The same voice that declares to Moses, "I am who I am," is the same voice that announces to the questioners, "I am." The narrative of Exodus pictured this moment when God would see and hear the suffering of his whole creation, come to deliver it out of the hands of sin and death, and be with it forever. Jesus is the one who fully reveals what God is like, because he is God. Through his life, death, and resurrection, we have seen that name, the I am who I am, clearly and definitively given content, but not just any. It is content that is entirely continuous and congruent with Exodus. Jesus sees the suffering. Jesus hears the cries. Jesus comes down to deliver. And Jesus is the one who is with us. Together, this Lent, let's not miss and long for the illusory certainties we have held dear and been comforted by in the past. This Lent, let's long for Jesus like Paul as we live a life of faith. As the world becomes more and more uncertain, as financial ruin threatens us all, as war and rumors of war circulate, as all forms of social unrest and instability escalate, don't long for Egypt. Don't long to be enslaved again for a taste of comfort. You have been called beyond those things to follow God revealed in Jesus. Where we have to follow Jesus looks like a wilderness and a wasteland, because it is one. But he will be your bread and your light, because he was and is before all things. He is the I Am. The peace of Christ be with you all. Thank you. this morning, oh, I guess you can sit down. I won't make you stand the whole time. Not that I plan to be long, but I've already done it once to you, so it might not be fair to do it again. You may have noticed that I tried to assimilate the story of Exodus as our story, because it is. We've been grafted into the nation of Israel, as Paul says. This is our story. And the Psalms constantly tell us that we're to retell this story to generation after generation after generation. So I'll read a psalm or a section of a psalm as a part of the benediction this morning. From Psalm 77. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have displayed your might among the peoples. With your strong arm you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. The clouds poured out water, the skies thundered, your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. This morning as you go, go knowing that you've been liberated from slavery to sin and death. You're no longer a people of bondage, but of freedom. Follow Christ your Lord.
Mm-hmm. You're free to stand one more time if you'd like.